Okay.
Good evening. So thanks everyone who stayed in our focus group on Monday. Hope to be applying some of that feedback as I muse over what that means to do. On some short-term things, I have been recording lectures. I'm not sure about the audio quality because the recorder is over there and I'm standing here. I hope to fix that in the future by having something to wear around my neck, but I don't today. I haven't the first few times I've been doing it, but I posted the recordings linked off the schedule page for what they do, and also theoretically screen captures, but obviously not Blackboard captures. That's one concrete thing, and I'm thinking about how to use other feedback about making the discussion better and incorporating your feedback from like paper reviews in a more obvious way. So today we're going to talk about locks, but before that I'd like to start with homework two. So everyone, and without exception, misunderstood part C of homework two, which meant that I must have written it wrong. The question was supposed to be about, so out-of-order processors in general overlap cache accesses, including misses, with other things. And that's where a lot of the benefit of being out of order is. And question three was supposed to be asking you, how much does this actually matter for this application? Or to put it another way, it's a roundabout way of asking, how much overlap is there anyways? How much of the time that there's a cache miss is the processor actually doing something useful in that time, rather than just waiting for the cache? And the hope was that you noticed that you had two baselines you constructed for that question. So one was, how much time does the cache actually take? That's why I asked you to look at the overall miss latency. So how much time is the cache actually taking? And you also have this baseline where you know how much time things take without cache accesses. So you know how much potential work could be overlapped with that. So you have some sort of baseline for that. But it's not going to be perfect, and that's why I asked you about the limitations of your estimate, because you're going to make some assumption. Since you can't actually modify the processor probably to do this, you could try, but based on the structure of the simulated processor, it would be a lot of work. And that's not what the question asks you to do. So any questions, comments about this, or what you're supposed to do for the question? Yeah.
Can I talk about solutions to this? Okay?
From a high level, yeah.
Okay. I'll talk to you offline.
Okay.
It has to do with, so there is a big limitation.
Yes. Whatever you do, you're going to be making an assumption about what kind of work overlaps because you can't measure that precisely enough.
I guess my question is something I would like to answer is how you would actually go about quantifying that limitation.
You probably can't quantify it.
Just mention
it. You can probably come up with a bound, is one thing. You can say that the performance would be at most this much better, is something you can say. So that would be an example where you can say, at least you can give something very concrete. And that would be a valid approach. Another approach you could say that assume that the application is uniform in how it behaves, you could do something like that. But you're going to be making a big assumption, and that means that, you're going to give some number, some range of numbers, but there's actually going to be some variance around that. So any question about this or any other part of homework two? And homework notes. So for all the homework two checkpoint submissions, I looked at them and made comments for everyone. Please read those. In some cases, I looked at your part A and it looked like you were reading the wrong thing and that could get you into trouble later, and certainly would like to correct it. We also handed back grades for homework one. The grades do not include any adjustment for lateness. We'll do that later, that's all. And there should be a breakdown if you think that I didn't give you points for doing something that you actually have in your report or something like that, please let me know. And I will take a look and correct it if necessary. So on to today's topic, which was about papers about doing locking. Taking advantage of these read, modify, write operations, like test and set, to actually implement locks. And to start off, I like to clarify something which confused a few people in the paper reviews about the second paper, which benchmarked a whole lot of locks. And that paper wasn't extremely clear about what they were measuring. They mentioned very briefly they were measuring application throughput. And that's not quite clear. Some people might have interpreted that as like lock throughput. That's not what they were measuring. They were measuring like the runtime of the application, or like transactions per second, or something like that. They weren't actually explicit about what they were looking at, or whether it was different between different applications. But that's what they claimed they were measuring, was sort of overall, something that was application performance. And conceivably that might have varied between applications. So any questions about this clarification about what the paper was measuring? It's mentioned very briefly. Like, it's like almost an oversight to them. Like, you know, they don't really care what they're measuring. But obviously, it is very important for the results.
Was the USENIX like a conference? Or?
The USENIX Advanced Technical Conference is a conference. It is like a second-tier systems conference. Like high second-tier. Like SOSB and OSDI are like the top tier, maybe, yeah. And like first to second tiers like EuroSys and USENIX ATC. They have like a different mix of topics as all the conferences do. Yeah. So with that, I looked through paper reviews and let's look at things that people didn't like or about their papers. Common themes. So probably the most surprising to me, and a very good point, is that the Anderson paper spends a lot of time talking about hardware solutions to improve locking, but ultimately doesn't really say much about it. How did people think the discussion of hardware solutions was? What were the problems with it? I know many of you wrote about some of them in your paper reviews, so. To give you a recollection, these were basically the solutions sort of things to do, like broadcast reads. What was the big problem with the paper that people have with the paper's discussion? Or what would you think it was? You didn't have it.
They didn't really quantify the benefit, did they? They didn't really discuss.
Yeah, so the paper said that these sorts of things would help. They didn't try to identify how much they would help. So they said doing a broadcast read. So when you have a failed test and set, maybe you can find out that it happened. Or doing something where you lock the bus and do a read, but don't actually validate the cache line on a test and set. They argue that it might help. These all have disadvantages. So doing the broadcast read has this disadvantage that it means that the cache needs to pay attention to reads that aren't for it. And that may not even be things they have in their cache right now, because they were just invalidated. And know to get it back in there. That's more complexity in the cache. And potentially you might put things back in which you shouldn't unless you have all your lock and strip control on it. And locking the bus for the read, that makes the test and set operation both more complex and maybe tie up the bus more than it should. And the paper made some guesses that this might make the cache slower, or the bus slower, maybe. But they didn't try to quantify like how much this would actually improve the bad thing they were experiencing, which was that performance collapse when you had lots of waiters. Yeah, this is a very good point about the paper, that this is definitely the weakest part of the paper, And I didn't think of it because I was basically ignoring the hardware solutions in the paper, assuming that they were not really worthwhile thinking about. But they were there. It was an important part of the framing of the paper. A big question people had with the Anderson paper was they wondered, you know, we've had these results. How do they, or do they, affect real applications? So who can give their guess as to what they think the Anderson benchmark was, the ones where they show those results? Yeah.
Did they mention that they were just looping over some critical section on Jupyter over and over again?
Yeah, so they were acquiring a lot over and over and over in a loop on lots of threads. Does this reflect what real applications do? So shaking your head. You think never?
I mean,
who thinks it never reflects what real applications do? Never, ever. There's no application that looks like that as far as what it does with blocks. No real application. This would be completely, there's no reason you'd ever have an application do this. Who thinks almost never? Who thinks sometimes? Sometimes there's an application like this. So you have a, is it someone who thinks sometimes put in the volunteer explanation for why?
Like a web server maybe, you would have threads that would collect or get the information or wait on some information, and as soon as it gets the information, it starts working on it. You would probably use the same piece of code to process the information.
Yeah, so like in a web server, you might have a common queue of incoming requests. That would be an example of this type of contended lock. It's not quite doing nothing in between, but it might be pretty close if most of the requests are simple. It's not completely implausible, but yeah, it's not. Doesn't seem like it's a good idea to have your applications do this. But it is a big complaint about this sort of work, especially since that this sort of benchmark they did is the thing which made their new locks look best. That acquiring the lock over and over again. So a bunch of people were disturbed that these locks didn't relinquish the CPU. So why would we want to relinquish the CPU? What's the reason that, that seems like a good idea that these locks aren't doing? So this is, yeah.
Well, it's gonna be a while before you can acquire your lock. If you just sit there pulling the whole time, you can't do work.
Yeah. So one of the things we need for this is that the CPU needs to have work to do while we wait. The other thing is that we might be waiting a while. So if both of those are true, it seems like we want to do other work. And the way we do this on a typical system is we give control to the operating system and tell it, hey, I don't have anything to do right now. Why don't you run something else? And the locks in the Anderson paper don't do that at all. So is this a problem for almost all applications? Who thinks almost all? Thinks some applications? So what's an example?
I mean, just one thing is, I think like part of the premise of it though was specifically testing cases where you wouldn't want to relinquish the CPU. So I felt like their research was tailored specifically towards assuming that you don't have other useful work to do and the wait time's not gonna be very long.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it's okay, I think, to just base your work off that, maybe?
Yeah, so they were making this big assumption, which perhaps wasn't stated extremely clearly, that indeed you had nothing else useful to do, because otherwise this is the wrong kind of lock to use.
Right.
And also that you wouldn't have to wait very long, which is from critical sections being short is a way for that to happen, hopefully. Another complaint was, what about thread priorities? So with the Anderson locks, who gets to go first?
choose one lock, and who has an answer for any kind of lock about who gets to go first, who gets to acquire the lock first if there are multiple users. Yeah.
Like one of the algorithms is the proposed was that you pull and then you get to increment some number, and based on that number, whoever has the highest number gets to.
Yeah. So.
Or the least number gets, and the next highest, and the next highest.
Yeah. So that's first in, first out. So one of these locks, the person who got to go first is whoever arrived at the lock first. That, if you have any notion of priorities, that's not going to obey it. So their other locking scheme didn't work that way. So who gets to go first in that case? This is the harder one to answer, not who gets to go first. So the other scheme was for example, test and set. So who got to go first on the test and set lock?
I guess whoever was able to access test first.
Like, yeah, so whoever's processor could get, if it's a shared bus, could get on the bus first. And if it's a distributed cache, like the dash system, well, some processors have an advantage. Because they're closer to wherever the directory for the lock is. And those processors probably get to go first. And that also doesn't obey any notion of priority we might have, unless it happens to be the case that our high priority threads are located close to the lock. Okay. So those were, I think, the biggest comments people had about the Anderson paper. So for the paper, which benchmark tons and tons of locks, the biggest complaint, and probably a pretty good one, was that there's so much data and so few conclusions. They had tons and tons of data, and yet you learn very little about what you should actually do. They don't tell you how to actually choose locks besides benchmarking 27 combinations on 27 locks times 4 different degrees of parallelism for each of your applications. They don't tell you what about the locks actually matters. They give this hierarchy of the locks, and then they don't use that later on when they look at their results. Like, so there's patterns. If you look carefully in the results, they're not very clear. It's very hard to tease them out. I didn't go through enough effort to actually figure out if they're always there, but you know, locks of a certain kind probably perform similarly. Like, there's some of their locks which are like the Q lock in the Anderson paper. And there's some of their locks which are more like the test and set and backup lock in the Anderson paper. And you know, you can't actually easily figure out which category, which flavor of locks, you know, performs better, or whether the performance is unrelated to sort of what category they're in. Some of those people also had concerns about their interposition library. So they did an evaluation which attempted to show that it was low overhead, but they only did it on a few applications.
Pretty amazing it worked. This blows my mind that you can swap out locks. Mm-hmm. Using one kind of lock is hard enough.
Okay, yeah. Especially since they implemented condition variables. Who here knows what a condition variable is? Who here does not know what a condition variable is? Or is not sure they know what a condition variable is? Okay. So condition variables are a topic mostly for an OS class, but we'll give you the very brief overview here. Is that there's something called a monitor, which is a lock and a condition variable. And the idea is that you acquire a lock on some data, so data dot lock, and you want to wait for something to be true. So while, you know, for example, let's say we have a queue. So we have a queue with a lock, and we say while the queue is empty, I want to wait.
And conditioned variables are a way of doing this way. So you have a weight function, which you pass a conditioned variable. We'll call this one has element. That corresponds to the thing we're weighing. And you also pass the lock that you hold while you test that condition. And what this weight function does is it waits for either a signal on this has element. So elsewhere, we have code which acquires the Q lock and adds something to the Q. Some say the number 42 to the Q, and then signal. Signals Q dot has element. Because it now has an element if it didn't before. And then unlocks the Q. So this wait function is going to release this lock and wait for a signal on has element. And it's going to somehow do that in a way where there's no race, where there's no time way that you will miss a signal. So then some other code can go on and acquire the lock since the wait released it temporarily, do something with the queue, and send a signal. And when the signal happens, this wait function will resume and acquire the lock again. And then you check the condition, make sure that between when you got the signal and when you resumed, nothing bad happened. No one else came in, acquired the lock in the queue, removed the element. Double check, and then you go on and pop the element off the queue. This makes sense? So they want to support this programming pattern. In an LS class, you presumably would talk more about actually using that. But they needed to support this, and their locks did not natively do it, so their wrapper had to do a lot of extra work for to handle this case. But their way of evaluating whether their interposition was safe was basically that they chose a couple programs they thought were really bad for the interposition and benchmarked that. But whether that is thorough enough, some people were skeptical about. Pretty legitimate to be skeptical about it. Especially since their interposition needs to basically protect a normal lock, a quote unquote normal lock, with the lock they're benchmarking. And so should add overhead, and it might depend on how that normal lock does. So any other general comments about things people didn't like about the paper that didn't come up here? Okay. So I'd like to talk about, apologies for font size here, something that's not locking. We'll talk more about this on Monday, but as a brief introduction, you don't always need to lock. So this is an outline of how you implement a lock-free stack. So let's say we have a stack which we'll represent as a linked list. And to add something to the linked list, we'll just create a new element. That should be stack node. Let's see what happened with this example. You create a new element, we'll set its value, and we'll set its next pointer speculatively. And then we'll atomically swap it with the current head of the stack. And so the idea here is that we create a new thing to add to the stack, and we set it up so it points to the current head of the stack, and then atomically, assuming the head hasn't changed from what we just set, we set the head to that value. And because we have this atomic compare and swap instruction, this read the head pointer, see if it hasn't changed, and if so, set it to our new item that we just allocated,
this will add to the stack or not, and we don't have to worry about locking, because this read, modify, write operation is a single instruction that is going to change that memory location all at once, or not at all, handles the entire update. So you don't need a lock for this. So that's reading. So y'all might want pushing to the stack, you might wonder about popping. So popping is the same sort of idea, but we swap the head with the next pointer. So instead of swapping the head of the stack with the thing we're adding, we swap the head of the stack with the thing that should be next on the stack. And if that doesn't work, we try again until we succeed. And you'll note that some trickiness here is that we probably actually need these memory fences here. We don't get it for free, at least unless our compare and swap is implicitly a memory fence. Another very tricky thing here is that we're returning the value we removed, but we don't actually have any code here which deallocates the thing we removed. And we can't actually just deallocate it here, because someone else might be in this loop, and they might have a copy of it, and might be trying to read from its next pointer. So there are real implementations of this, but you need a lot of extra logic to handle safely deallocating the thing, or to be using a garbage collected language that's multi-threaded. But the idea is that these atomic operations, the same ones we see being used to construct locks in the Anderson paper, we can use more directly. And this should be lower overhead than locking, especially if it's usually uncontended. So any questions about this lock-free stack idea?
So just what's a ballpark estimate of when this spin locking is better than relinquishing the CPU? How expensive exactly is a context switch? Because here the argument is that it's a lot cheaper to just keep spinning on the...
So that's not the argument here, typically. Some people might have that argument. So typically, when people are recommending a lock-free data structure, typically their notion is that you usually don't have to do this. Usually this condition is going to be false and you won't have to loop. That's their hope, because that's definitely the best case. If you have contention, my intuition is that lock-free data structures will do worse. I'm not sure if that's actually what happened. That would be my intuition. As for the question of how do you choose between spinning on something and relinquishing the CPU, that depends mostly on the length of your critical section, right? It's how long are you likely to have to wait? And that is, versus how long a context switch takes. And to figure this out, you probably measure how big is the context switch penalty? And that's tricky to measure because most of your context switch penalty is like cache misses from polluting your cache with something else. But you want to compare those, figure it out. And it also depends on what extra work you have to do. Because if you have exactly as many threads to run as cores, it never actually makes sense to relinquish the CPU. Other comments, questions? Okay, so this lock-free stack is pretty simple. It turns out that you can do most of the data structures you can think of in a lock-free way. They're all gonna have this pattern where we always make a new copy of something when we add something to it, because we don't know who else is accessing it. And we always have a little bit of trickiness whenever we want to delete something from it, because we need to make sure no one else is accessing it right now when we actually free up that memory. But you can generalize this so there are implementations of, for example, lock-free binary trees, balanced binary trees. that's a lot trickier than this. There's a lot more cases. Implementing a balanced like red-black binary tree is hard enough already. And this makes it a lot harder, but people have done this. So in addition to hopefully being better if usually you don't have contention, there's a nice property that some people really like from these lock-free data structures that's sometimes known as weight freedom. And that's the idea that if we stop all other threads, we can still make progress. So this happens with this data structure because if no one else is running, we're guaranteed that this compare and swap will finish successfully after like one iteration. And so lock-free data structures often have this property, which means that they might be good for low latency. Of course, I haven't given you any bounds in how many times we loop here. So that's not so good for latency. Fortunately, however, we're guaranteed that someone will succeed at the compare and swap because someone will do it first. So at least we guarantee progress. This is not true of all lock-free data structure proposals. But then they have this sort of niceness. As for whether they're really used, that's a more complicated question. They're not, I haven't seen them very commonly used in normal applications. But the Linux kernel, and I think other operating systems do use them. And Linux kernel has something which is a lock-free data structure called read, copy, update. And you can see that name from how we implemented the lock-free stack. We want to add something to the stack, we need to make a new copy and update it. And we have some old copy that's lying around that eventually we need to get rid of. And the very tricky part of this read, copy, update implementation in Linux is that there's very complicated logic for figuring out when you can safely delete something. The basic intuition is that they run something on every single core to make sure that enough that every single core has passed the time when they might be reading the value. And this means that writing is really slow because you have to do work on every core to make sure everyone's done having any copies of the value you updated around, so you can delete the thing you copied. But this is really good if most of your data is read-only. Because reading this data structure, even if it's being updated concurrently, reading our lock-free stack here, if we were just reading and not popping, if we were peeking instead of popping, has no locks, no locks whatsoever. So if read is your common case, this is lower overhead than any scheme involving locking. But writing is more expensive. So the Linux kernel uses this for some things which are read very frequently, but updated very, very infrequently. And next time we'll be looking at a sort of more general idea about hardware-assisted lock-free data structures. And the papers where you will talk about doing them, the equivalent things in software, and these are the sorts of techniques that are used to do that. So any other questions about lock-free data structures? Comments? Yeah.
So the first paper that we read didn't, I think one of the complaints was that didn't you test against realistic applications, and the second paper did only realistic applications. Like, is it a good, is there a good mix that you should test against these benchmarks and then also test with these kind of applications? Isn't that what you wanted to instead of just testing one class of applications?
Do people have throw this question back? This is a good question. So what did other people think about? Yeah. Should we test like the multi-core locks are unsolved paper Or should we have tests like the Anderson paper if we say what to show that a new lock is good? Or do we need both? No opinions? Okay.
I think given how unclear it is when a lock implementation can benefit you, it would seem that to me that a micro benchmark would be more useful.
Mm-hmm.
As you're programming your program, you know the details. If you had a series of micro benchmarks that showed under what conditions which locks performed well, that would be more useful to you. Since it's not clear that there's a best one, it's not clear how useful it would be to know that this is the, like, you know, with 52% probability, this is the best for my implementation. So,
Sure, I would think that given the number of, for every lock, they have pros and cons of variables. So presumably in certain applications, you'd want to use one kind of lock or sort of class of locks more often. So I think finding out what kinds of test cases best reflect your specific domain and then just using those for certain locks might be more helpful than testing all of them for every lock.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so I guess the consensus here is that you want some more granular information about when the locks are useful, and that's not something we got out of the huge macro benchmark paper. And you probably need something more micro benchmark-like for that.
The large benchmark paper, I mean, at best it shows that all the locks are mediocre, really, because I mean, it says the best one is like 50% effective across the applications.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think if you're introducing a new lock, that's necessarily what you want to present to the world.
Yeah.
That, it works for half of applications in one test.
Yeah.
So,
do you think that's what the Anderson paper presented?
No, I think that was different. That was like, I think much more specific, I think. The data still wasn't great, and it maybe wasn't super realistic, but they at least were able to produce a nice graph that shows that it's faster than all the other things that they tried, or more effective, rather.
Okay. So let's talk about what was happening in the Anderson paper. Why was there the performance collapse that they needed to fix with this simple spin lock here? And way to look at it is how this happens on a CPU. So the lock is busy somewhere on CPU 1, and CPU 2 wants to acquire it. And what happens, they say, in their patch coherency protocol, is that CPU 2 does a test instead. And the way that happens to be implemented is that you do a read for ownership. You do a cache invalidation to get that lock in the exclusive state. And this means that you've got the lock in the exclusive state, invalidating the CPU which has it. And then later on, that CPU which has it is definitely going to need to invalidate you again to change the lock, to acquire the lock and change its value to clear. And then you're going to need to invalidate again in order to actually set the lock to busy. And that's seems pretty inefficient. Lots of messages back and forth for just conceptually a thing which only needed one message. And with three CPUs, it's a whole lot worse. So with three CPUs, we have the same starting point where CPU 2 gets the lock, gets it in the exclusive state, does an invalidation. But then CPU 3 also does that. And this can happen forever. Then CPU 2 can try to get the lock from CPU 3 and invalidate it. And so we have this ping-ponging effect. And that's likely the primary reason we saw that huge increase in the Anderson paper, in their graph, for the performance of test and set. That you can have an arbitrarily large number of invalidations while the lock is held if more than one processor is contending on it. And their micro benchmark was pretty much set up exactly to produce this scenario. Like, it could have been set up more if they, like, had the critical sections last longer. So eventually, CPU1 is going to write back the lock again. And after that happens, it modifies the lock, and then everyone else has to do another set of invalidations to read back the lock. The first, whoever goes first, let's say CPU2, manages to set it to clear, but then CPU3 still needs to do yet another invalidation in order to figure out that, oh, I didn't get the lock. So instead of sending one message, which is sort of our conceptual idea of how much we should send, we end up sending a whole bunch of messages just to release the lock and transfer it, not even including the extra messages we sent while waiting to find out that it was still held. So we get this sort of, depending on how you count invalidations, with one processor waiting in our test and set lock, we have three invalidations just to transfer the lock to the waiter. And with two processors waiting, we have up to infinity invalidations. It's arbitrarily bad. And even the best case is pretty bad because of the extra work when the first processor releases the lock, that both waiters are going to acquire it exclusively. So the first fix that Anderson had was based on the observation that, well, if we're not going to get the lock anyways, we should just not try to invalidate that cache line. We should just read normally the lock to see whether we can get it or not. And hopefully, most of the time, that will be more efficient than invalidating everyone else. And in particular, this avoids ping-ponging. We're not going to ping-pong while the lock is not held if we're just reading it, because we're not going to invalidate the other person who's trying to see if the lock is still held. And so that gave this test and set scheme. So in that case, we do a normal CPU2 instead of doing a test and set right away, does a normal read. And CPU1, if we're using something like MOSI, can keep the lock in its cache. And CPU2 gets it in the shared state. And CPU3 can get it in the shared state. And at this point, as long as CPU1 doesn't release the lock, there's absolutely no activity on the cache. CPU2 can check if the lock is available, and it does that without sending anything on the bus. Because it knows, as someone with the lock in the shared state, that it's going to be told if that value is invalid. It doesn't have to ask. Now, this wasn't true of all the systems that Anderson was thinking about. But it's certainly true of modern cache coherency protocols, that if you just read it, you aren't going to have to keep pulling to figure out whether it changed. If it's in your cache, someone's going to tell you. That's how the cache coherency protocols we expect work. And so eventually, CPU1 is going to need to modify the lock, so it's going to actually invalidate it. So it's going to tell everyone, nope, you can't have that lock value anymore. And that's going to be our necessary invalidation. And then everyone's going to read the lock and find out that it's clear. And someone's going to get to modify, actually do the test and set. And someone's going to do it first. So let's say again that CPU2 wins. So CPU2 does the test and set, makes the lock be busy and modified. Then CPU3, well, it saw the lock was clear, so it's definitely going to do a test and set. And it's going to say, oh, okay, I got it, it's busy. Oops, I didn't win the race. Lock's busy because CPU2 got it. I invalidated the line because I thought I could change it. Because it did a test and set, thought I could change it. And with more processors, this is going to scale pretty badly. So with more processors, we'll have this storm of tests and sets when the lock gets released, and only one of them is going to succeed. And that was the reason why test and set was not the best performing option. because every time after the lock is released, we have this storm of requests. It's not as bad as test and set, where plain test and set, where we have that storm all the time while the lock is kept. But we still have this sort of storm of useless messages invalidating the patch line. But it's a lot better than we were before, as far as invalidations go. So if invalidations are whatever expensive, it's a lot nicer. So what was the Anderson paper's solution to this problem? The first solution. What did they change about the test and set block? Yeah.
Did they explicitly queue the threads?
So that was the later solution. So one of the solutions they had was to have an explicit queue. But before that, they had an arguably simpler solution. Yeah.
Was that the one where like it gave every single thread like a time to wait before it's checked again?
Yeah. So they had a bunch of solutions which were all the category that we wait before we check again. So rather than as in here, we acquire the lock, and immediately I do that. I try to acquire the lock. The policy was that you wait a little afterwards, then check the lock again, and see if it works. So usually, you just do an extra read, and you don't actually invalidate everyone else's copy of the lock. So you don't get this storm of invalidations. Followed by reading again and validations, which uses a whole lot of bus time. So as long as everyone delays a different amount, this is going to work about as good as you can expect, in that everyone's going to delay a little bit, but then you're going to do a normal read. No one's going to lose their copy of anything. And then whoever delayed least happens to get the lock. Another approach is you delay between each test, but they're basically equivalent as far as what they can do. So one big question is how much do you delay? And there were two basic approaches there. So one was what you mentioned, that we just give each processor a number in advance and say you always delay that much. So we assume that everyone detects the lock being released at the same time, or close enough to the same time. And we say, processor one, you delay 1 microsecond. Processor two, you delay 2 microseconds, and so on. And the hope is that by doing this, since we all detect it at the same time, that whoever has the lowest number goes first. So that scheme seems pretty good if you know that everyone's actually waiting in the lock. But doesn't work very well if you don't know that. So they had an alternate scheme, which was more adaptive, which is exponential backoff. So who here has taken a networking class? Okay, only very few people. So this exponential backoff, if you take a networking class, it will be very familiar because this is essentially what it's done in wireless networks for arbitration commonly, and done in old school Ethernet. Not the type of Ethernet we use anymore. And so on wireless, when you send a message, you don't want to send a message while someone else is sending a message because only one of you can use the ring. And you want to somehow make sure that you're probably not sending at the same time as someone else. And a common way of doing this is exponential backoff. So you delay a random amount of time. And the idea is that the sort of the delay versus number of nodes sort of increases exponentially, or increases, you might even increase, something like that. And the way you actually arrive at that is you say, oh, did I lose? Was I fast enough or not? And depending on that, you jump up or jump down. Say, did I actually get interference? If so, I'm going to delay more.
So the way to do that for the lock is you say, oh, did I try to test? Did I test and set and then test the lock and lose? If so, I'm going to delay. Next time. And if I won, I'm going to delay this. And you can use that sort of technique to dynamically adjust how much you back off. And that should let you do it in a way where you don't need to know in advance how many people are waiting on the lock and assign slots. And that's useful if you want to make a lock implementation for real applications, because asking your programmer who's using your lock to tell you how many people are using this, how many threads are using this, is not a great thing. So whatever delaying technique, as long as you actually make the delays different enough, you sort of end up with something nicer. Something with, that's more efficient. And that's where you end up. So there's another type of lock I'd like to talk about, which I have the wrong description for, so I will just write on the board. And that's a ticket-based lock. So they talk about a queue-based lock, but there's an intermediate step called a ticket-based lock, which appears in the second paper, which is basically half of the ticket-based lock. So as we discussed, was mentioned earlier, the idea of the ticket-based lock is that it's actually FIFO, that you take a number, and that's your position. Whoever has the lowest number goes first. And you increment the next number for the next person. And this needs an atomic read and increment operation, which we can implement with compare and swap if we need to. And it happens to be a common atomic operation. So the ticket lock is basically a simpler version of this. So to acquire the lock, so lock operation is my number is read and increment. Increment the next number. Okay. So we have a next number counter in the lock. And then while something called currently serving doesn't equal next number, do nothing. So this is our spin. So instead of spinning on is the lock clear or not, you spin on is this currently serving number S. So this is exactly the sort of, if you've seen take a number in a deli or something like that, exactly sort of the intuitive algorithm that you're following. You get a number, pair a machine, only one person can do that at a time, and then you just stare at the currently serving number until something happens. Yeah, where your number is there. So more of the work is going to be done in the unlock step here. Just was the case as the case for the queue lock. And that's going to be that we're going to set currently serving to currently serving plus one. So we're going to increment the number that's being served. And that's how we unlock the lock. And then whoever's spinning on this lock will read the new value and say, oh, that's my number. Or they may say, oh, that's someone else's number, still need to keep going. And that's all. So that's a ticket lock. So getting this number is taking a ticket, and you're waiting for your ticket to come up. And so the queue lock was a version of this where instead of having a central counter for who you're serving that you loop over, we had a separate thing you checked that was independent for each processor. And the idea was that you'd have even less interference. But the ticket-based lock gives us a lot of it seems to require more operations, but it gives us one of the bigger advantages of the scheme that, of the queuing-based scheme, and that is fairness. So in the test and set scheme, as you mentioned earlier, everyone, who has to wait the least, who knows? Whoever happens to be fastest at accessing the memory. This scheme is fair. If you're first in, first out. If you get to the lock, you know that you're going to be served in a bounded amount of time. There's only so many threads ahead of you.
And this is not something that many of the locks evaluated in the papers actually do. And the Q-based lock was the paper's example of a lock which did this. And they didn't mention really, they mentioned that it did this, they didn't evaluate that effect. But this makes sure that go in order. And the scheme of having a separate place to look also made sure makes it a little more efficient. So lock fairness in general, and apologies for the formatting, is not, like for test and set, is not great. So, which is the reason you might want this lock, this ticket lock, even ignoring any of the overhead issues. So if I did test and set, I ran a couple threads, see how many times each thread acquired the lock. And it's not balanced. And why it's not balanced, it probably has to do with how close things are on the network over which cache coherency things happen. Maybe with who got lucky in thread scheduling or something, but it's not balanced. So this was the big graph from the Anderson paper. Pretty hard to read graph, unfortunately. But one thing you'll notice is that from this graph, can we see that any lock is better than the other? Start with that. So on this graph, is any lock just better than another lock? Yeah.
Sure. So looking at the backup ones,
mm-hmm.
just better.
What?
Yeah, backup. I think the backup REL one is strictly worse than
some of the other backups.
Backup REL. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have one lock here, which is strictly worse than the others.
I think for the Q lock.
Yeah.
It gets better with cruising over processors.
Yeah. So if we only care, so otherwise we have these mixed priorities. And the Q-lock is the best example of that. So this Q-lock is definitely worse in cases where we don't have many threads trying to acquire the lock. And definitely better when we have a lot of threads trying to acquire the lock. And this is a common pattern you're likely to see with lock implementations, because the Q-lock does a lot of extra work in order to acquire a lock. You have two memory locations instead of one you're accessing, at the least. But it avoids all that contention after you do that work. There's no real contention while you're waiting on the lock. And you can see that effect here, in that you get this, you know, sort of nice, low overhead, as long as that's not important. And the other locks sort of have this sort of variation in when they're good, which is a little more subtle. But this is a general sort of property we see of locks, that they vary in where they're good. Okay. So earlier we talked about relinquishing the CPU. I'd like to give a brief note about how that works. So it's not actually entirely obvious, you know, what that would mean to do if you went to still use these locking mechanisms. And a good intuition you might have is you might think that the OS has to do the entire lock. There's no way that I can use a spin lock and relinquish the CPU. But it turns out that many of the locks that were benchmarked in that second paper do what they call parking. And that means that they relinquish the CPU. And they do this where they first try doing something like a spin lock or a queue lock or a ticket lock does, and then have some way of relinquishing the CPU if they're waiting too long. And this is a very common lock implementation technique, is to first do one of these locks which uses all the CPU up, and then switch to relinquishing the CPU. So hopefully, if you have to wait a while, you know, something else can run. And if not, you probably didn't use too much.
So the paper mentioned using Futaxes.
Linux.
So Futaxes is a Linux support for doing this. And basically, it's a system call, which has two modes that we care about. There's a whole bunch of other things. The man page is huge. One of them is wait. So the kernel gives you a system call, which is go to sleep, semi-process to sleep, as long as this value isn't changed. And there's a wake system call, which is wake up someone who's waiting on this value who went to sleep. And the Linux kernel very carefully arranges to make sure that there's no time between when you decide whether or not to go to sleep and change the value where someone can sneak in and get something wrong. And basically the mechanism for that is that you basically, you check the value, then you go to sleep in a way synchronized with anyone who's trying to wake you up. So you make sure someone who's trying to wake you up acquires a lock before you go to sleep.
How is that done efficiently? Do they just like monitor every memory location, like every
register? No, so you read the memory location. Right. So the idea, so the trick is that you make sure that someone would have to call wake. So the policy is that someone needs to call wake, and sometimes they'll be calling wake when there's no one to wake up. But you make sure that if they call wake, you don't miss that call. So that's what we're doing. So we don't actually have to do something funny where we make checks if someone's looking at that memory location. We just have to make sure that if someone calls wake, there's not a window of time where they would decide to call wake and we wouldn't wake up based on that. Which basically means that before you go to sleep, there's a little bit of period of time before you actually put the process to sleep, in which case the wake call will keep you from going to sleep. So ticket locks and queue locks were most of the locks that were ticket locks, queue locks, and the test and set locks were most of the locks benchmarked in the second paper. But there are a few other categories. So one category was locks that were designed for NUMA systems. And sort of an intuition for locks in NUMA, by NUMA I mean things like our dash, the dash system, where you had different local memories, and some parts of memory were remote. And that sort of system is better to spin on a local value. You want to be talking to your local directory, not some remote directory, for all that time that you're going to be just checking, do I have a lock yet? And one scheme which does this was benchmarked in the paper. It's called an MCS lock. And the paper benchmarked an MCS lock and like 10 variants of an MCS lock. So an MCS lock, you can read the paper if you want to find out the details, but the summary is that it looks almost the same as that Q lock that was in the Anderson paper, except instead of the Q being kept in an array, the Q is a linked list, a lock-free linked list, like that lock-free stack I showed you. So this is another case where you want a lock-free data structure because we're implementing a lock. Don't have a lock to begin with. So you have a lock-free queue, which is implemented with a linked list, and the linked list nodes for our flag that we're going to spin on is allocated in our local memory. So we always spin on values in local memory, and that's how an MCS lock works, and that's why it should be nicer for one of those non-uniform memory systems, where you have local memory that you want to be accessing all the time because it should be a lot faster. So another type of lock they talk about were hierarchical locks. And there the intuition is that let's say everyone's waiting in the lock. We'd like to first figure out locally who should get the lock and then figure out globally who should get the lock. So we communicate locally first if there's multiple waiters. So one way you can think of doing this in Dash, for example, is that you might have one local lock per node, and you have to acquire that lock before you wait on the global lock. In this way, that there's only one waiter per node waiting on the global lock. People seem a bit confused.
Maybe, no comments, questions? Okay. So this is with the idea of hierarchical lock. So we're making our lock overhead higher in the uncontended case, definitely, because we have to do basically two locking operations. But we're making the waiting case better because we're usually going to be waiting, resolving who's waiting locally. They also talked about a weird strategy of delegation. And essentially the idea of that, this was not clear to some people since they didn't describe it very well, is that, you know, instead of like having a lock, one thing you could do is you could like run a server thread on a dedicated core to do your operation for critical section operations, for everything you're doing protected by a critical section. And you have a lock for a queue to send stuff to that, and it just takes stuff off the queue. So this is kind of nice, elegant in that you just add stuff to a locker queue and wait for a signal on the thing you added to the queue that it's done. And it gives you locality for the thing accessed by that critical section because it's handled on a different thread processor. And always the same processor if lots of people are trying to do something with the same data. So they had schemes which do something similar to this. I didn't actually look up the details. They apparently only sometimes do this. Like only when it's contended do they send it to a server thread. But
you're saying like the APIs for this is just lock and unlock, and the compiler library is smart enough to figure out it's just been off a server thread and build this queue and throw this fork on it.
I'm not sure what the details are. A way you could implement it is by just switching it to another thread, the processor, or something like that. I'm not sure what the details are and how they actually implemented it. But this is a sort of idea that you might, that is a pattern, so I don't know about the details of those locks, but this is a common pattern in like operating system programming that people do to have good performance. Because it's often better to send a message to another core to do something than it is to have a lock. Because sending a message to another core is as expensive as acquiring the lock. And if something's going to be waiting on that core anyways, it's just as fast. Or it's faster. You don't have to wait to hear back from it. So we had this huge universe of locks. And all these sorts of different trade-offs. And I don't think this was ever expressed well in the papers. And certainly you wanted, from the first paper, what you were looking for and didn't get was some notion of, you know, here are a whole bunch of factors for why you might choose locks. Here is which lock is better for which case. And you didn't get that. But sort of factors we have, so one is uncontended performance. And that's talked about very little in these locking papers because they, you know, that's usually very good. But some things like the queue lock, when it's uncontended, it's clearly a waste compared to test and set. And many of these other locks are that way. If they do something expensive, even in the case where you don't have to wait for anyone. Another issue is how much memory traffic. That was primarily what the Anderson paper was concerned about. How much are we wasting time on the bus? And this is a bit subtle. So the notion in the Anderson paper is they just looked at how much you could acquire the lock. But how much memory traffic you use also affects how much useful work other processors can do, because they want to use the bus for, say, a calculation. So if you're spending lots of bus cycles managing the lock, they can't acquire things from memory for their calculation or send things to memory to store the results of their calculation. And our big concern with memory traffic is that a lot of these simpler lock schemes have bogus invalidations, have cases where you evict a value from another cache and it's going to have to reread that value and you aren't actually going to change it. And we had some locks which essentially avoided those bogus invalidations entirely, where there's no way for that to happen, like ticket locks, ticket and the queue-based locks. So another issue is that you can have excess delay. So some of these schemes depend on guessing how long to wait. And if you wait too long, you're just wasting time. And you have to make a choice about how long to wait. And if you're dynamically doing that, you know, there's a question of whether you know, the amount you're supposed to wait changes infrequently enough that you're actually doing it right. Another big issue is fairness. So we had some of these locks, like the Q-lock, which actually give us fairness of a certain kind, in that first in, first out. And some people complain that, well, what if we have thread priorities? We'd like our lock to give the highest priority thread to go first. That's what's fair in that case. And we would need a different kind of lock to do that. Many of the locks we looked at, it's very hard, very impossible to do. There's just not enough information around. We need to do extra bookkeeping. And another issue we wanted is that we wanted locks that release the CPU. So in cases where we're waiting a long time and have other things to run, we really like to let the OS do things. And some locks let us do that easily, some don't. Not really mentioned explicitly is that there's hybrid approaches that try to do this when you're waiting long enough. And that, by the way, is probably the typical default pthread implementation that they were comparing to. It's usually something like a spin or a ticket lock followed by releasing it if you wait too long. Not necessarily. So, I guess I'm almost out of time. So let's talk about a preview of the topic for next time. So we have two papers for next time about transactional memory. So transactional memory is a concept that is sort of a user interface concept. And this can be implemented by hardware or by software. And there are probably more software implementations of transactional memory than hardware ones, but it's been a very hot topic in the hardware community for a long time. And for a long enough time that there are multiple rather experimental but hardware implementations in shipped commercial processors. So Intel has one, AMD has one, Spark has one, I think IBM will have one. Like, so lots of people have, or has one, yeah, lots of people have at least partial implementations of some form of transactional memory in their processors. And the sort of model for transactional memory is that you have a block of code that you mark as a transaction. If you're familiar with databases transactions, this is actually very similar. This is basically the same thing. So you have your transaction, and you do stuff with shared values, whatever you like. And all those changes happen as if all at once, with no one interfering, or not at all. The guarantee is that the whole transaction runs as if it ran all at once, with no one else running at the same time, no one manipulating the values. And either commits, that means the changes happen, or it aborts, means the changes don't happen. And the way these are implemented efficiently, one implementation of this is that we just acquire a global lock every time at the beginning of the transaction and then release it. That would be a valid implementation, but no one who's proposing using transactions actually wants to do that. So the implementation trick is that we'll try to do your operations. We'll just do it, and then we'll see if we run into a conflict. We'll see if someone else actually was interfering. Someone else was manipulating the same shared values, was reading from a value you were reading from or something like that. And if they were, we'll repeat the transaction. We'll just restart from the beginning, or reset everything that we changed and restart from the beginning. This is also the same implementation strategy that is commonly used in databases. And so the paper we're going to read about is going to talk about doing this in hardware. And sort of the one way of looking at this is that this gives you, a nice interface for programming a lock-free data structure. We're doing essentially with the compare and swap that did for that stack lock-free queue, lock-free stack, in that we try to make the change and detect the conflict, and if not, we retry. And this is a generalization of that, where instead of just detecting it for that single value, we detect it for a whole bunch of values for you. And this lets you easily write that lock freestyle and maybe get pretty good efficiency from it. So there's two papers that we're reading. So one is Hurley and Voss, which is sort of talks about making a hardware implementation. So like, what are the instructions that we actually compile that do transaction block to? And that means that in this example, code for the retry, that's not automatic. So there's some compiler tricks that are happening where the compiler generates the code to retry the block if it fails. And it also talks about how to implement it efficiently. And the basic trick is that we're going to take advantage of states in the cache, just like for crash coherency, just like we're using to implement locks. And the second paper is one which is a critique of transactional memory, arguing that maybe it's not that good. Okay, so.